Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast, a show for savers, investors, and entrepreneurs, helping you to stay informed, invest wisely, and achieve the unimaginable. Now, on to the show.
Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast. This is Todd Zempel, and today with me is Joe Gordon. For the podcast today, we invited a friend of the firm, Burl East, to the show. Burl is portfolio manager for the Altegris Opportunistic Real Estate Fund. Burl not only has a very interesting story to tell, he has an absolute killer track record. We definitely wanted to get Burl on the show, learn about what he's doing, and share some thoughts on the direction of real estate investing. So let's jump right in. Burl, welcome to the show. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm the chief executive officer of a San Diego-based company called American Assets Capital Advisors. We are in the real estate securities management business. So we manage money for mutual funds on the sub-advisory business and pension funds, insurance companies, families, foundations, and endowments. And the space that we operate in is real estate stocks. It would include things like REITs or home builders or development companies, stuff like that. It's global in nature, although in practice, it's almost, you know, it's probably 75% domestic, but we have a global mandate. I am a little bit north of 60, been doing this for 40 years, spent roughly 20 years as a sell side securities analyst. And roughly 30 years, kind of part of that time, overlapping as an investment banker, and now run this company, which is what I used to do before. I was a sell-side securities analyst in real estate stocks. And so this, for me, is the kind of third iteration of stuff, but within the same space, right? I'm operating in the same class of securities, doing the same kind of stuff. And we run about $850 million. And we run the Altegris AACA Real Estate Securities Fund, which you guys are invested in.
Yeah, and speaking of that fund, so we've been big fans of what you've done there. When I just look at raw performance, you beat the index last year by 36th percentile. I mean, you just knocked it out of the park on a relative basis. Beat the category by over 33%, and the history goes on from there. Obviously, you've done a really good job knocking out of the park. How have you done it? What's the philosophy behind this fund?
Well, we sort of march a little bit to a different drummer. Okay, so the industry has about 80 or so folks that do things like we do, and they're some of them are, you know, big successful names, folks like Fidelity, people like that, right? And what most of the industry participants tend to do is to pursue an index-like strategy. They start with the idea of what's in the index, and then they modify slightly at the edges, and then they seek out value within that process. That leads to index-like returns. Sometimes they'll do a little better, sometimes a little worse, but it isn't a different road. It's just, you know, cars bumping up against each other on the same freeway. We've taken a different path. Our path is to own monopolies, basically. I'm 61 years old. I've been in investments for, this will be my 39th year. And I can tell you, you know, categorically that the best investment strategies involve companies where there's a limited number of suppliers. There's a limited supply. The user, in our case, the tenant, but it could also be the customer, has a very high demand for whatever the thing is that you're selling to them. The customer has extraordinarily high switching costs, meaning that once the customer is your customer, becoming not your customer is very difficult. And then at the customer level, in our case, it's the tenant or the customer wakes up every day and says, gee, I need more of whatever it is you're selling. So that is our strategy. So, you know, there's 30 or so sectors within real estate. Some are obvious, things like office or apartments, and some are not obvious. It might be infrastructure or hydroelectric dams or data centers or lab space leased to pharmaceutical companies, things like that. So it's a very, very broad business, by the way. And there are like 600 companies in it. So it's a big, giant supermarket. So we walk through the supermarket picking ingredients around this idea that we're trying to identify, underwrite, and own monopolies. Now, it is rare to get a monopoly, but it is not that difficult to find duopolies where there's two competitors in a segment of the business, or an oligopoly where there's maybe a handful. What we generally try to avoid, though, is owning businesses where the returns are cyclical and there are times in this wrestling match between the customer and the supplier, right, between the landlord and the tenant in our business, where sometimes the tenant is winning because rents are going down and the tenant has more choices, and sometimes the landlord is winning because rents are going up. That kind of business tends to be cyclical, temporary, timing related. We tend not to pursue those industries. We tend to pursue businesses where we believe that the landlord has an opportunity to maintain very high occupancy and raise rent on a consistent basis over a very long period of time. And by that, we mean usually 5 to 10 years. So, for instance, what we wouldn't do is say to you on a Tuesday morning something like, well, you know, today, we would almost never start a sentence with that concept. Today, like apartments in Charlotte are less expensive than apartments in Atlanta. So we'll find some company that owns Charlotte apartments and we'll sell some company that owns Atlanta apartments. We don't do that. So that's kind of our basic strategy.
Thanks for that. And looking at holdings within your fund, a big source of the outperformance last year looks like it was mostly to do with data centers and 5G cell phone towers. Can you speak a little bit to that trend?
Yeah, broadly speaking, the demand for mobile data in the U.S. is growing in the mid-40s per year. And this is everything that ends up in your phone, right? So it is both data, and some of it's encrypted data like your email, but it's also music and web search and Instagram and things like that. And per device, the consumption of data is going up. Then there's people have multiple devices. And then there's the idea that things that previously weren't connected to the internet, which might be, your refrigerator or your household appliances now are, or your automobile. So there's a proliferation of devices, and those devices are always using more data. So the way for us to play that is to invest in both cell phone tower companies, which own cell phone towers, obviously, hence the name, but they also own distributed antenna systems and small cells. And then they additionally own things like metro fiber, which might be fiber running up and down your street, and backhaul fiber, which might be fiber between two big cities, D.C. and New York. And then the data center companies, which is where all the data lives. And so this secular demand driver, this idea that consumers and businesses are using more data, we don't think that's going away. In fact, we think it probably accelerates because there's a half a dozen technologies that are, I would say, moving from the drawing board to real life, big data, AI, autonomous vehicles, and AI uses like photographic recognition, facial recognition, topographical map reading, stuff like that. We'll take this demand for data and move it, at a pretty good pace. And so we have been invested in that for 5 or 6 years now. And we also think it has benefited from COVID, right? There's this idea that, folks have been staying home. And so they, have been using remote access for devices and laptops and iPads and so forth, and also been shopping online more. Right. So they have been consuming more Netflix and more Amazon instead of going to the store or going to the movie theater. So that's the logic behind that positioning for us.
And you were clearly early to that trade, to that positioning. So kudos to you to seeing the trend. Obviously, your foresight has rewarded investors handsomely. So kudos to you for seeing that.
Yeah, that's broadly correct. We sort of figured this out probably in 2011, 2012, and started investing back then. And you're right, for 5 years, people were like, why are you doing this? And we would explain why, and they would say, okay. And a lot of times we will be early to an idea. And it's later looks obvious, but maybe it didn't look obvious. We tend to do a lot of deep research. We tend to be like a dog with a bone. We get an idea and we will really vet that idea fully. We will visit all the properties and all the companies, and we'll talk to all the analysts, the investment bankers, and the customers, and we'll build a really good, like, topographical landscape of how all the people in the business work together. And then we'll try to make some decisions based on that. And when we looked at the telecommunications and mobile business, when the iPhone came out, you know, it started this. But by 2010 or so, the idea that people were moving storage online, and also big companies, right? Part of this was you were a company and you had your own data, right? You're Pfizer. You have gazillions of terabytes of drug records, right? And you need to, that needs to be stored and accessible and secure and all that. And there's been a significant move by corporate America to outsource their data centers. And then in addition to that, you had 4G and now 5G improving connectivity. And when that happened, you had folks that previously looked at the cell phone as maybe a tool, now look at it as a tool and an entertainment device and a companion, right? I mean, a lot of younger people just, they won't go 3 feet without their phone. And so we were early to sort of recognize that and I think found a productive way to invest in it.
So, Burl, where do you see the emerging trends? I noticed that you've got some gaming stocks. I think it's MGM in your top holdings now. Is this a play on every state licensing legalized betting, or is it just the reopening of the global economy type thing?
Yes to both of those. So the gaming business is really an interesting business because in some ways it's like lodging. It has the same sort of component where when people travel, you know, gaming stocks tend to do well, as do lodging stocks. But lodging is not a oligopoly and gaming is. There's really four companies in the U.S. There's, you know, Sands, Wynn, Caesars, and MGM. And so part of it is, as you suggested, let's go backwards. You talked about the online gaming. We'll cover that in the second answer. But the first answer is yes, as COVID goes away and people become, you know, inoculated, suddenly there's like a move to travel, right? People have been stuck in their homes for a year. They've deferred vacations. There's all kinds of stuff where people are just itching to get out. And we think the first thing to happen will be the drive-to markets, right? So people will drive to vacations as opposed to fly. And so Caesars has the biggest footprint in the U.S. and MGM is number two. So if they have a location close to you that you might drive to, that picks up first and that's already picking up. So for instance, gambling, or rather, you know, sort of the business in Las Vegas is down about two thirds from kind of what you'd call normal. But the business regionally is down one third. So it's still down, but it's doing twice as well as Vegas itself because Vegas is largely an air, fly to market, unless you happen to live in LA, right? So we're investing because we think that the recovery is in place. There's been a significant amount of fiscal stimulus and Caesars and MGM will benefit directly from people getting out of their houses and traveling. That's part one. But the bigger thing is part two, which is this sports betting and iGaming thing. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it's legal in about five states. And there's like another 10 states that are in the process of legalizing this. And what happens is governors will talk, right? One governor will say to the other, hey, we legalize this and we're generating some tax revenue and so forth and so on. In addition, legislatures, when they look at this, will say, well, gosh, this is an activity that's already occurring, particularly sports betting. People have, you know, fantasy football leagues at their office, right? So if you tell a legislator, hey, there's an activity that's already occurring and you can tax it, they almost always nod their head up and down, right? So we believe that there'll be a widespread legalization of sports betting and iGaming over the next, call it 5, 6, 7 years. And the number one and number two beneficiary of that should be Caesars and MGM. Part of the reason is if you're going to offer an electronic format of something in the state, by and large, you need a physical setting, right? So a state legislature will not allow you generally to run online sports betting unless you have a location in that state. And so since Caesars has the biggest footprint, they win that contest. Caesars also has about 61 million people in its total rewards program. So it has an installed like connection to its own customers, which is an electronic connection. And so what they're going to do is roll out, they're already rolling out sports betting in states where it's legal, and it shows up on your phone and it's tied into your rewards program and it's tied into a concept they call One Wallet. And One Wallet might be where you'd have your rewards, you'd have how much money you spend, you might get incentives to go stay at Caesars in Las Vegas, you can gamble online, all that kind of stuff. No one's exactly sure how big the sports betting market is yet, and there are a wide range of estimates. If you look at what Caesars is saying, though, and I think they're probably the most sophisticated party in this space, they think the market is roughly $30 to $35 billion. To give you a frame of reference, gambling in Las Vegas is a $7 billion business. So what Caesars is saying is that the potential for sports betting and iGaming in the U.S. over like 5, 6, 7 years is, call it, five times the size of what happens now in Las Vegas. So we think that is a really big idea. Now, again, these are estimates and these are dependent upon a bunch of things we can't control, like the speed at which states legalize. But clearly you would look at this and say, okay, there's something here. And so we've put about 14% of the portfolio into a combination of Caesars and MGM, and to a lesser extent, Las Vegas Sands. Now, Sands and Wynn do not have a U.S. sports betting business per se because they don't have a physical footprint. Wynn has assets in Vegas and one in Boston, and Sands is basically just in Vegas. But what Sands and Wynn do have is exposure to Macau. And so historically, Macau has also been about a $35 billion business, but it isn't right now. It's down about 80 to 90% because of COVID. But we think when COVID goes away, like call it this time next year or even the end of this year, we believe that travel to Macau will resume, and the normal pace of activity will resume, and Wynn and Sands will benefit from that. So that's, as I said, that's kind of 15% of the portfolio.
So one of your top holdings has been this great story, Fortress. Can you update us on that? I noticed, I think Morningstar said you were selling some shares. I mean, things can't go to the moon, but you've done really well in that one.
Well, that started out as an infrastructure story. It's called Fortress Transportation and Infrastructure, and we like infrastructure, right? These are long-term assets with long-term contracts. They're typically inflation protected. They typically generate income, right? So that was our entree to the name. What has happened for the company, though, over the last couple of years is they have expanded their aircraft leasing business, right? They had this business where they would own an engine and lease it to a carrier. The carrier might be Southwest or United Airlines or something like this, okay? So that's how the business was working, and it was a good business before COVID. And then COVID came along and, of course, destroyed air travel, right? So their ability to rent out their engines and things like that was temporarily hindered. And so the stock collapsed in kind of the second quarter, and we ended up buying a significant amount of stock at pretty attractive prices. But in the background, what's really happened very powerfully is the company has started to build for itself what we would describe as a monopoly in aircraft engines, right? So this is going to be like a 2 or 3 minute story, so I'll apologize in advance for the detail I'm going to give you, but it's necessary to understand what's going on. The engines that they own are called CFM56 engines, the engine that powers the 737 and the A320 and the A319. It is the Toyota Camry of the skies. It is the largest installed base. There's roughly 22,000 of these things in use, and they generally work in non-international travel, right? So it's like Southwest. It's like I'm going from Phoenix to Denver. They tend to be short-haul flights, okay? So that business, by the way, is going to return before international, so they're very well-positioned. If you own an engine has a roughly 5-year maintenance cycle, and every 5 years, you retrofit the engine. And when you retrofit the engine, it costs about $5 to $6 million to rebuild the engine. And then the engine is effectively new and you run it again for 5 to 6 years. And engines go on like this nearly forever. Airframes, like the plane itself, depreciate to zero, but engines don't. And engines, by the way, are modular. You take them off the plane, you put them on another plane. It's like a Lego thing, right? So the company's focused on engines, not on airframes. And they own these CFM56 engines, which are the workhorse of the world. And what they're doing is they have built a platform with three joint venture partners to take the cost of the renovation, which is this $5 or $6 million, you know, because it's called a hot cycle engine, to do that to down to like $2 million or $3 million. So for their own engines, their cost of maintenance is going to get cut in half. And the reason is because they have figured out with Lockheed Martin how to modularize the engine and swap parts of it out. Secondly, they've figured out with Chromalloy, who is an aircraft parts manufacturer, how to build third-party parts, which cost significantly less than those you buy from General Electric, who is the builder of the engine. And then they have figured out with a company called AAR how to create what are called used but serviceable materials. And all of these value-added components in the engine maintenance process have reduced Fortress's cost of renovation from ballpark $6 million, which would be market, to ballpark like $3 million. So for the engines they own, they become twice as efficient. And secondly, they're going to vend this process to other carriers. So let's say you're a large carrier, and I'm just using this as a name, by the way. They don't have necessarily have a contract, but let's say you're Southwest, and you have lots of 737s, and you want Fortress to do your maintenance now because they do it at a cheaper price. So what we think is happening is they're building, they've been working on this for 4 years, an actual monopoly. And again, that was our original thing. So we go to monopolies, doing a monopoly in aircraft aviation maintenance in the world's largest market for aircraft engines. And they're the only ones doing it. So this is not a normal thing for us. Again, we were attracted to the company because of infrastructure. This was a secondary business. But the secondary business is now taken over as the primary business and appears to us to have an enormously large potential into the future.
Interesting. So when you look at research and you do new opportunities or looking for new opportunities, are there any new investments in the portfolio that align with a new trend that you're seeing out there of monopolistic real estate or infrastructure or anything like that?
Well, you know, of course, the data centers are a new business. I mean, they're not new this week, but they were new 10 years ago, as was cell phone towers. These things, these businesses didn't exist a decade ago. The lab-based business existed, but in a smaller way a decade ago. So we're constantly underwriting new areas and also new geographies. For instance, we have about 15% of the portfolio in data centers that are basically in Asia Pacific area. So it's a combination of like Singapore, Malaysia, India, and China because the growth is faster. So that's like a new thing. So we're always looking for new areas where there's, again, a limited number of suppliers, limited supply, our normal mantra. Having said that, it doesn't happen that often. We will underwrite new sectors, new areas, new ideas all the time. And more often than not, probably 90% of the time after doing the full underwriting of whatever the idea is, we will conclude that it's not as good an idea as we thought originally, or maybe not as good as idea things we already own. But we do go through the process on a fairly constant basis of looking for new companies, new spaces, new ideas on a fairly constant basis. I mean, for instance, we don't own Airbnb, but we underwrote Airbnb fully, and we actually like the business model. Now, we don't like the business model at today's price, but if Airbnb were 2/3 cheaper, we would probably own it because we think that is a sustainable business model. It's asset light. There's a brand name there. They're really not competing with anybody. So we like that. We were going to buy it at the IPO, but the pricing was overpriced then, and it's really overpriced now. But the basic idea we liked. So we're kind of doing that as we go along. And, you know, we're always hopefully open to new ideas. And I don't say adaptive, but we're trying to make sure that we're not blindsided, like loving the stocks we own now and rejecting everything else.
So when you look into the future, and again, in a parallel way to legalized gambling, sports gambling in the U.S., there's also the state-by-state trend of legalized marijuana. And are you looking at any logistics or real estate opportunities and companies there that are going to own that space?
Well, that's a really good analogy you've come up with, because we think they're very similar. The medical marijuana industry started becoming legalized state by state probably a decade ago. And I'm just making up the number. I really don't know exactly how, but it feels like a decade ago. And it was one state, then it was two states, and it was four states. And if you flash forward to today, what you find is that more states than not have medical marijuana licensed. I can't remember what the number is, but it is well more than half. And I think a little bit less than half have recreational, right? So, but it's been a process, right? Where states have gone, you know, what happens is one state will do it and the other state will watch and observe and say, okay, well, what are the problems they didn't anticipate that they ended up facing, or what were the opportunities? And they'll do an analysis. And so let's say Colorado does it and, you know, New Mexico doesn't, and Colorado watches New Mexico or vice versa. And they again, governors talk and they go, hey, here's what we found that was good. Here's what we found that's bad. If you're going to do this, maybe you ought to take these lessons to heart, and it rolls out. We think the same thing will happen in sports betting. But as far as marijuana goes, what we've done is we've bought a company called Innovative Industrial. And what Innovative Industrial does is they own the space that they lease out as greenhouses to the growers, right? So they'll own a greenhouse, and the grower will be the tenant in the space, and they will, you know, pay rent. And so the company we own doesn't touch the product. They're not in the marijuana business per se. They're in the kind of real estate business. They're a REIT, and they're simply collecting rent from these medical marijuana growers in states where it is, you know, it's available, you're legally available to grow. It's been a really good investment for us. Our sense, for what it's worth, is that sometime in the next, probably in the Biden administration, we wouldn't be surprised if the federal government took cannabis off of the Schedule I drug and made it a Schedule II drug. That would enable people like Pfizer or Merck or Lilly to do legitimate actual research on creating, you know, regulated prescription drugs or non-prescription drugs formulated from medical marijuana. The business now tends to be a kind of a loosey-goosey concept without real prescriptions. Instead, doctors are giving what they call recommendations. And so we think that will probably happen over the next couple of years. And when that happens, we believe that the demand for both the space and things like IIPR, the REIT itself, will go up, and the stock will probably rally dramatically into that. And again, there's not many folks doing it. It's a limited business. And it's a weird business because at a state level, this is legal. But at a federal level, it's illegal, which is very strange. And the Obama administration decided to simply ignore the fact that it was illegal. And they did that by issuing a memo called the Cole Memo, which told the Department of Justice not to enforce federal laws when those laws interfered with state laws. So the feds just said, hey, basically, we're just going to not bother to enforce the federal law. In states, you can do whatever you want. We'll leave you alone. So that went along, you know, fine for a number of years. And then in the Trump administration, they canceled the Cole memo, but they didn't do anything about the business. And now we're back to a Democratic administration. So what we suspect is someone will dust off the Cole memo, except it might have a different name this time. And when they do it, there were a number of Democratic candidates, folks like Cory Booker, for instance, who were very vocal about legalizing marijuana than when they were running in the primaries, right? So we sense is there's enough like commonality of thought at the federal government level to do something which would legalize this even further, and that should probably be good for the space. So that's our approach. And again, we think of this as a metaphor for sports betting. It will go state by state by state. It'll take a while to build some steam. There will be bumps along the way. But when you look back 10 years from now, our sense is that in the same way that marijuana was legalized, sports betting and iGaming will end up in the same sort of place.
Now, Burl, so we've talked about cannabis, sports betting, cell towers, data centers. How do you envision that investors position your fund in an overall portfolio?
Well, the first thing I would tell most investors is that they're underweighted to real estate broadly. So this is not talking about my fund specifically. This is a general concept. Real estate as an asset class has done a terrific job of creating long-term wealth over long periods of time. It's not fully correlated. It's not uncorrelated anymore because it reacts to market conditions, but it is a little bit less correlated. It produces generally reasonably high, decent levels of income. It produces inflation-protected returns generally, and it broadly, now setting aside the Great Recession, broadly is not subject to cataclysmic changes unless the changes are caused by government, typically. Okay, so I would say that if you were to talk to a long-term investor like an endowment or a foundation, and they tend to be very long-term in their approach, they're usually 7, 8, 9% real estate to as high as 12 to 15. Let's say the average is 10. So your average institutional investor is 10% real estate. I suspect that your average retail or individual investor is not. So first thing is you're probably underweighted. Point two is publicly traded real estate, REITs and real estate stocks broadly, have outperformed private real estate. Over any rolling time period of more than a couple of years, public beats private. And there's a couple of reasons for that, but the biggest one tends to be fees. Running a REIT costs, 75 to 100 basis points of fees, whereas private transactions, you invest with some individual that's doing a deal to raise money to go buy some building or something. Usually there's acquisition fees and disposition fees and, there's a promote and all kinds of other stuff. And those fees add up to be 2 or 3%. Versus if you just bought let's say it was an apartment, we were doing a private. If you just bought an apartment REIT, the fees would be 30 basis points, right? So part of it is fees. The other part is public companies have access to less expensive debt and by and large have access to smarter people. There's been a brain drain in the last 30 years from private to public real estate because it's just easier and more scalable and more leverageable and all that kind of stuff. So point one, you probably don't own enough real estate. Point two is REITs and things like that. Real estate stocks have done better than private real estate. The other things that REITs bring to the table is, first of all, there's governance. You have boards of directors. You have normal corporate governance. You have rights as a shareholder. The second thing is it's liquid. You can change your mind. You can wake up in the morning and say, I want to go buy a boat and go do it. The third thing is now we're transitioning to people like me. As a portfolio manager, I can change my mind, right? I can wake up this morning and say, I like this stock 10% more this morning than I liked it yesterday, based on maybe its earnings call or something that happened, I can buy some. So at the margin, I can constantly adjust the portfolio to best optimize what I think is going on and what might happen. So I would tell investors, own more real estate. You should probably own public real estate and then find a fund that's really well run, like a five-star fund. It doesn't have to be us, by the way. There's 7 or 8 other five-star funds. But find a well-run five-star fund and put it away for 5 to 10 years. It's not a timing issue. I wouldn't attempt to outguess the portfolio manager. And most retail investors are terrible at timing anyway. And just think about it as a long-term investment in something that should create significant wealth over time. And that would be my advice to investors.
Perfect. Well, thank you. Burl, any additional closing thoughts before we end the podcast today?
There's been enormous damage to the economy done by COVID. And some of this is like permanent in the sense that people's behaviors have changed, right? So things that might have been really, really valid businesses a year ago are less robust now and may never come back just because people's, again, if you looked at like office, for instance, we think that, 20% of people don't want to work at office at all anymore, and another 60% want to work there part-time, come and go. So we think there's a diminished demand for commercial office space, right? So there's been some pockets of real estate which have been damaged and won't recover. And then there are others which have done really well, like data centers and, communications network systems. So that's been a weird year. And then, of course, also the government, both under Trump and now under Biden, have provided substantial amounts of fiscal stimulus. And so we've sort of drunk on liquidity right now. The whole market is. And so we're in a bit of a weird time where it is hard for me to tell you like exactly which way the tide is going, because there's just conflicting tides right now between liquidity and the Fed and businesses that have changed permanently and not permanently. So I'd say stay flexible, but always try to invest in a business that you think will be worth more 10 years from now, regardless of the cycle, right? So you should, instead of thinking about like the quarter or the week or the month or even the year, really think about a 5-year time frame. That's what we try to do.
Got it. Well, thanks, Burl, and thanks to everybody for tuning in today. If you would like more information about Burl and his firm and his strategies, you can visit their website, aacadvisors.com, or you're always welcome to reach out to our firm, wealthqb.com. Thanks a lot, folks. We appreciate you tuning in. Have a great day.
Information in this podcast is presented for educational and entertainment purposes only and is subject to change without notice. Opinions expressed are those of the participants and don't necessarily reflect those of Gordon Asset Management, LLC, its producers, hosts, or guests. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risks. Neither Gordon Asset Management, LLC, nor its podcast participants shall be liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast.